Let me begin this morning with a... I hope you never don't get tired of these little pieces from Jim Carroll's book, Elements of Hope. But I would like to read one... Oh, let me find it. This is called, The Thing Is Not to Ask God Too Many Questions. The thing is not to ask God too many questions because he is dumb. He does not answer. He waits till things are simpler. Next year, perhaps, there will be an answer. The thing is not to think of God as a nice fellow because, take it from me, he is tough. If you let him, he will scorch your hair with fire. He will drown you naked with his water. The air of his breath can be awful, and he will surely bury you with earth. Hope is a matter of lowered expectations. It is when the great marble statue topples of that comforting God who tucks you in his safest pocket, the magic mystery who always makes things better, when it topples, though you flee on your head, it is then that the real God of Job's old fight stands up glaring. What else is there to say from the pile of our ruined expectations but, hope is not what I thought it was, or, even though you slay me, and he will, I will trust you, which is another way of saying, my God, you must be kidding. Hope like that is hard, especially for narcissists like us. The thing is not to take God too seriously, because by our standards, God is slightly crazy. Here is hope. By his standards, we are slightly crazy too, and that is what you and I and God have in common. Common craziness. Theologians call it grace. Ah, well, that's a prelude to what we want to talk about this morning. Those of you who have outlines will notice that this is a kind of two-week tour through Mark's gospel, except that I forgot that in the 2 weeks came the 4th of July, so we're going to do tomorrow's section on Wednesday, and I'll probably bring together Wednesday and Tuesday in a single session. But the main point of giving you an outline of the whole gospel, of having you see the whole thing, is because the way Mark makes his point is not only in the things that he says, but in the structure, in the very putting together of his gospel. We're in the middle of the gospel in these days, Friday, Saturday, and today. And the middle of the gospel is Mark's key to the whole gospel, because it is about the way Jesus is Messiah, namely by going to the cross, which was a totally new idea for the people who experienced Jesus for the first time. They knew a tradition in which the Messiah would be the triumphant and victorious king. We heard about that in the Old Testament lesson last night. That's a great passage, but notice, although there's humility in there, and breaking the weapons of war, and coming with peace, and not having a standing army, there's nothing in there about this king dying, you see. Nothing in the whole tradition of the Old Testament about a coming king, an anointed one, a son of God, dying. There is a tradition also of a suffering servant. We know that one from especially the second half of the book of the prophet Isaiah, where we have the servant songs. But that tradition was never linked with the king, the coming king tradition. What Jesus does is to put these two traditions together and to say the Messiah will be the suffering one. Already, that just blew people's minds. They said, it isn't going to be that way. It can't be that way. Even the disciples said that. But the other thing is not only how the Messiah will be in the world, but also, and more importantly, or at least equally importantly, what that way of being in the world says about the disciples. The gospel is about Jesus and his disciples and how his entry into the cross makes our entry possible. Now, All of that comes together in this central section of the gospel, where we have Jesus teaching the disciples three predictions of the passion in Mark 8:31-9:1, and in Mark 9:30-37, and now today in Mark 10:32-45, and three misunderstandings by the disciples, and three teaching of the disciples about what their participation in Jesus being in the world will be like. And Mark introduces this, signals it, tells us, pay attention, by two stories of the healing of the blind, in a way saying, you disciples don't understand, you're the blind ones, but the blind, they see, they understand, look, you know, they get the point when you don't catch it. So here we've got Mark's gospel in its very structure shouting this message to us. Okay, so today, the third prediction of the suffering. Mark begins this section with a bunch of teachings. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on each of them, but I want to say something about, I want to say at least a little something about each one of them. The first one, beginning with verse 38, John said to him, Teacher, we saw a man casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he was not following us. But Jesus says, don't forbid him. No one who does a mighty work in my name will be able soon after to speak evil of me, for he that is not against us is for us. That's a kind of strange twist. The saying of Jesus that most of us remember, or at least the one that I remember best, is a saying in which Jesus says, he that is not with me is against me. He that does not gather with me scatters. That's from Matthew 12, verse 30, where they were accusing him of doing works, mighty works, with the power of the devil. And so this almost seems to be a contradiction to that, because Jesus is saying, he that is not against us is for us. But the point is that not all neutrality is hostile neutrality. There is friendly neutrality as well. But I think we need to ask about this saying of Jesus, because in one sense, what Jesus is saying in both of them is there really is no neutrality. Let me give you some examples of whether the neutrality is friendly or hostile. In James Michener's book on Kent State, a really powerful and devastating book about the tragic events at Kent State in 1970, he contrasts two riots. One was a riot at Kent State that involved the burning of an ROTC building, which was worth probably some $10,000, and the riot involved less than 1,000 students. The other was a riot that took place in November of the same year in Columbus, which involved 15,000 students and destroyed some $50,000 worth of property. In one riot at Kent State, the guardsmen were not neutral. They eventually fired into a crowd of students, wounded 9, killed 4. At Columbus in November, the police stood around laughing at the rioting that was going on and made no attempt to stop it. In the one instance, we were destroying some symbols that were very dear to us, namely the ROTC building. In the other instance, we were affirming some symbols that are very dear to us, namely the victory of Ohio State over Michigan in football. No, I say this, and Michener lays it out almost that way. I mean, when you look at the number of people involved, the amount of money that was involved, then the neutrality of the police in Columbus was benign neutrality. every year, every other year, I'm sorry, every other year it's Michigan's responsibility, but every other year, the city of Columbus budgets $25,000 to remove the parking meters within a two-mile area of Ohio State on the Michigan, on the weekend of the Michigan-Ohio State game. It is cheaper to do that than to replace the parking meters after we have won and rioted. We almost don't have that big a budget for snow removal in Columbus, let me tell you. It's wild, it's crazy. The religion of Central Ohio is football. So that the neutrality of the police after the Ohio State Michigan football game is a benign neutrality, you see. Well, all right, that's an example, I think, of the question of, is your neutrality for me or against me, you see? Let me just give one other example. In Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, Tom Stoppard's brilliant play in which he turns Shakespeare's Hamlet inside out, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are, as you know from Hamlet, assigned to carry the letter to England, to the King of England, that Hamlet is to be executed on the spot. They do not know the contents of the letter until they are on the ship going to England with Hamlet. And then they find the letter, open it, read it. To their astonishment, it says he should have Hamlet's head cut off. There is a silence as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern talk to each other. And then Rosencrantz said, "The sun's going down," or "the earth's coming up," as the fashionable theory has it. Guildenstern, "Do you think so?" "I was just making conversation." "We're his friends." "How do you know?" "Why, from our young days, brought up with him." "Oh, you've only got their word for it," says Guildenstern. "But that's what we depend on," says Rosencrantz. "Well, yes," says Guildenstern, "and then again, no. Let us keep things in perspective. Assume, if you like, that they are going to kill him. Well, he is a man. He is mortal. Death comes to us all, etc., and consequently, he would have died anyway, sooner or later. Or look at it from the social point of view. He is just one man among many. The loss would be well within reason and convenience. And then again, what is so terrible about death? As Socrates philosophically put it, since we don't know what death is it illogical to fear? It is illogical to fear it. It might be very nice. Certainly, it is a release from the burden of life, and for the godly, a haven and a reward. Or look at it another way. We are little men. We don't know the ins and outs of the matter. There are wheels within wheels, etc. It would be presumptuous of us to interfere with the designs of fate or even of kings. All in all, I think we'd be well advised to leave the matter alone. Tie up the letter there, neatly, like that. They won't notice the broken seal." "But what's the point?" "Oh, don't apply logic." "But he's done nothing to us, or justice. It's awful." "It could have been worse. It could have been us," says Guildenstern. So they seal the letter back up and proceed to carry it. Now, you see, they can justifiably say, "But we've done nothing," you see. Their neutrality in this instance was a hostile neutrality. They had done nothing. It would be presumptuous to interfere with the matters of the rulers, the kings, and so we do nothing, you see. I talked to many people in Germany when I was there whose phrase was, "Die da oben," the ones up there, you see. They did it and we didn't know what was going on. And so often we say the same thing. All right, well, I don't want to spend any more time on this point, but Jesus' word is, in a sense, there is no neutrality. In the same way, then, some of these following teachings. "I say to you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you bear the name of the Messiah will by no means lose his reward. And whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a great millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea." Again, If you look at all of these in the light of in a sense no neutrality, our neutrality is either going to be benign or hostile, then friendship to those who are the Messiah is a good thing, and attempting to draw people from the circle of the one who is Messiah is a bad thing. And then these hard words. C.S. Lewis somewhere says, don't ask me to defend this. I'm only explaining Christianity. I didn't invent it. If your hand causes you, this is one of those hard words, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than with two hands to go to hell. The Greek word here is Gehenna. Gehenna is literally the valley of the Hinnom, and the Hinnom Valley is where the garbage of Jerusalem was burned. And so we get the vision of a fire that's always going on. He's saying here it's better to enter life maimed than with two hands to go to Gehenna, to the unquenchable fire. And if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life lame than with two feet to be thrown into Gehenna. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into Gehenna, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. All of these, in a sense, are ways of saying that our relationship to the kingdom is a decisive one, and that it is either life or death, that it is either participating in God's business or being alienated from him. Well, again, I didn't invent these sayings. Then come three quick sayings about salt, each one of them with a different point. Every one will be salted with fire. Really a way of saying purified with fire. I'll come to that again when we come to the word on baptism. Second saying, salt is good, but if the salt has lost its saltness, how will you season it? That is, can you put seasoning back into insipid salt, into salt that has lost its reason for being? And the third one is about fellowship. Have salt among yourselves. That is, have salt is an ancient Near Eastern way of saying that you are to keep fellowship. The Arabs have a saying, there is salt between us, which means we're in company with one another. So have salt among yourselves means be at peace with one another. All right, now the next section, 10:1 to 12, has to do with the question of divorce. Let me just say here about this section quickly that that what is at stake here is an argument between the disciples of Hillel and the disciples of Shammai. And it has to do with the interpretation of a passage from Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 24, there is a regulation or a law that has to do with divorce. And maybe I can just read that section to you quickly. The Deuteronomy passage is, when a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a bill of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, we don't have to go on for the rest. We don't have to say anything about the rest of this passage. The key word in here is because he has found some indecency in her. The question that Shimei, the disciples of Shammai and of Hillel debated was what that indecency is. In other words, what are the grounds for the divorce? Hillel said, any cause, any way in which a wife displeases her husband is grounds for a divorce. The disciples of Shammai said, no, this means only indecency, only unchastity. Indecency means only if she has been unfaithful. But the argument is still, over whether or not, over what the grounds for a husband's divorcing his wife are. Jesus' reply is, for your hardness of heart, Moses wrote you this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. So they are no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And when the disciples ask him about this again, he says, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Our familiarity with these passages, in a sense, dulls us to the dynamic newness of what Jesus is saying. To the disciples of Hillel and Shammai, who are arguing over what are the grounds for a divorce, Jesus is, in one large sense, saying, you're missing the point. Because the point is not on what grounds may one legitimately put one's wife out of the house, but what is God's vision for marriage in the first place? And when he replies to the disciples, notice what he says. He says, first of all, that a husband who divorces his wife and marries another is also committing adultery. In Israel, the wife was the property of the husband. She was chattel. She belonged to the husband. Therefore, in all of ancient Israel, only the wife could be unfaithful. The husband could not, you see. And the unfaithfulness consisted in, a man could violate another man's wife because it belonged to the other man. But if he has an affair with a woman who is not married, even though he is married, that was not considered adulterous. In one sense, Jesus is here striking a blow for the equality of men and women in the marriage relationship. He is saying, he is in a sense breaking through the chattel notion, the property notion. It is an astonishing thing that is happening here. A brand new statement of the relationship of men and women, which says whoever is breaking the marriage is playing falsely with the spouse. That's new to Israel's tradition, new to Israel's teaching. All of the arguing, in a sense, Jesus says about who has a legitimate ground for breaking the marriage is in many ways missing the point. I think of all the ways in which the traditions out of which I come spent long years arguing over whether or not or who had the right to get the divorce when a marriage breaks up, and therefore who has a right still to remain in the church. Those arguments, in a sense, go back to Hillel and Shammai and perhaps actually miss the point of what Jesus is up to. What is a vision for marriage? What new thing might be happening if there is a new... If the reign of God is breaking in a radically new way? Well, we could spend a lot of time talking about this, but let me go on now to the main point of this whole section. And it consists now of the passage that begins with the bringing of children and ends with the teaching of the disciples in verse 45. It's a long section, but these are its components. First of all, they bring children to Jesus. And the disciples want to put a stop to it. And Jesus then says this word. He was indignant with the disciples. And he says, let the children come to me. Do not hinder them, for to such belong the kingdom of God. Truly I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom as a child receives things, really is what he's saying, shall not enter it. And he took them in his arms and blessed them, laying his hands upon them. Then comes the rich ruler, who says, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit life?" And Jesus says to him, "Why do you call me good?" In other words, are you just being polite, or do you really notice something? Do you know the commandments? Do not kill, do not commit adultery, do not steal, do not bear false witness, do not defraud, honor father and mother. He said to them, to him, "Teacher, all these I have observed from my youth." And Jesus, looking upon him, loved him and said to him, "You lack one thing. Sell what you have, give it to the poor, and come follow me." And at that saying, his countenance fell and he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. And Jesus looked round and said to the disciples, "How hard it will be for those who have riches to enter the kingdom." And the disciples were amazed at his words. But Jesus said to them again, "Children, it is how hard it is to enter the kingdom. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle," probably a small gate in the wall, "than for a rich man to enter the kingdom." And they were astonished and said to him, "Then who can be saved?" And Jesus looked at them and said, "With men it is impossible, but not with God. All things are possible with God." And then Peter says, "Oh Lord, look, we've left everything and followed you." And Jesus says, "Truly I say to you, there is no one who has left home or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for my sake and the gospel who will not receive 100-fold now in this time houses, brothers, sisters, mothers, children, lands with persecutions." With persecutions, and in the age to come eternal life. But many that are first will be last, and the last first. To put all of this together now, listen to what is happening. The disciples still have the vision of the campaign, you know. We're going to make it to the White House. Kissing babies is all right, but you can't spend a lot of time, and there are no votes there, all right? But this big giver, this fat cat who comes, who has much possession, so, you know, that Jesus spends time with the kids, and sends the rich ruler away, or at least says to him that the one thing they needed, money, is what he's got to give up to come and follow him. That boggles the mind. So they are amazed at his words. You know, they just, this isn't the way it works, huh? Jesus says, "Do you really know again what's going on and what the kingdom really is about?" Well, when they discover, you see, what the values of the candidate are, then they leap to be on board once again. "Oh, yes, Lord, see, we've left everything and followed you." And then Jesus says, "Great, great, yes, that's wonderful. Boats and fish nets and so on, and you'll get it all back with persecutions." He always throws this little word in. And now comes the climax of this section, the third prediction. They were on the road going to Jerusalem, Jesus walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. Things are beginning to sink in. The tension mounts. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem. And the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit upon him and scourge him and kill him. And after 3 days he will rise." The prediction once more. Where does the misunderstanding come in? Watch. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, come forward and say to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do?" And they said, "Grant us to sit one at your right and one at your left in your glory. We want the rooms on each side of the Oval Office." But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they say to him, "We are able." Oh, brave, stupid men. Now, notice how our own expectations are shattered once again. My prediction would be that Jesus would now say to them, "No, boys, you know, you can't drink my cup and you can't be baptized with my baptism. That's for me alone. But he doesn't say that at all. Whatever stupid, foolish, misguided thing they said, whatever they meant by it, oh yes, we are able to put up with the rigors of the campaign, we'll go without much sleep and work 7 days a week until we get there, but when we do, that is, we will drink the cup and be baptized with the baptism, but when we do, you see, then give us the positions on the right and the left. Jesus doesn't say, no, that's for me alone. He says, you're right. The cup I drink, you will drink. And with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right or my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared. You know, you can't help but wonder how they kept telling this story after it was all over and after they knew the true identities of the one on the right and the one on the left when he came into his glory. The Gospel of John picks this up, and Jesus says, as he is about to go to the Father, that is, go to the cross, Father, glorify me. And the glory is the cross. The reversal of all of their expectations, the reversal of all of their hopes, there was the glory of God, there on that hill outside of Jerusalem. And there were the two on his right and his left when he came into his glory, and it turned out not to be James and John, but two criminals. Back to the baptism. You will drink the cup, and you will be baptized. But to sit at my right and left is not mine to give. When the ten heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. See, again, missing the point. Jesus calls them to him and said to them, you know that those who are supposed to rule over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all, for the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Jesus is now laying it out clearly and plainly once again. The redemptive reign of God happens not at that point that we exercise authority over one another, but at the point where we are set free to serve one another. And that's the way in which the baptism is shared and the cup is shared. Let me just read a section from Lewis's The Problem of Pain yet to close this. MacDonald, one of the people whom Lewis admired most, George MacDonald from the 19th century, had said, Christ is easy to please and hard to satisfy. Lewis comments on this. Love is more stern and splendid than kindness, for kindness involves a fundamental indifference to its object, something even like contempt of it. Kindness cares not whether an object becomes good or bad, provided only that it escapes suffering. But if God is love, then he does not want us to have happiness on any terms, in contemptible or estranging modes. Rather, if God is love, then he, by definition, is something more than mere kindness. It appears from all the records that though he has often rebuked and condemned us, he has never regarded us with contempt. He has paid us the intolerable compliment of loving us in the deepest, most tragic, most inexorable sense. And then Lewis concludes this section. When we fall in love with a woman, do we cease to care at that point whether she is clean or dirty, fair or foul? Do we not rather then first begin to care? And does a woman regard it as a sign of love in a man that he neither knows nor cares how she is looking? Love may indeed love the beloved when her beauty is lost, but not because it is lost. Love may forgive all infirmities and love in spite of them. But love cannot cease to will their removal. Love is more sensitive than hatred to every blemish in the beloved. Of all powers, God forgives the most, condones the least. He is pleased with little and demands all. That's why Jesus
lets us in on his way of being, why he gives us the baptism with which he is baptized and shares with us the cup that he drinks. His love will not let us remain with our blemishes. He commits himself to us utterly so that he can cleanse us totally. Well, it's a scary thing to be in on, but that is what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. All right, we'll continue on Wednesday with the journey to Jerusalem.